You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Interstate Batteries is a proud supporter of the Sportsman's Nation, and these guys have been around a very long time. And why do you stick around a long time? It's because you treat your customers the right way, and you provide your customers with a product that works. So if you want to find out more information about Interstate Batteries, their history, their company culture, their devotion to the customer, what you need to do is visit interstatebatteries.com or stop into one of their thousands of retail locations all over the United States and talk with a battery specialist today. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Friday edition of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and the Nine Finger Chronicles is brought to you by Vortex Optics. Now, I don't know about you, but there are days where if you ask me what day it is, I probably wouldn't know. I would just be guessing. And I know that there's probably some of you who feel like that, So I'm trying to go and enjoy my weekend, right? I'm cutting out of the office a little bit earlier than normal, which is, when I say office, it's my house. We're leaving early on Friday, and we're heading up to get away from our house for a little bit. We've rented a cabin up in Northeast Iowa. We're going to go fishing with my father-in-law. He's already sent a text saying he knows where some good fish are at. We're going to go to a farm pond. We're going to do some hiking. We're going to spend some time outside, isolated and hopefully away from the TV, away from our phones, away from any of this craziness that is happening, and just focus on family and focus on ripping some lips. So that's what I got coming up this weekend. Hopefully you guys get outside and do something exciting as well. And speaking of exciting, today's guest, we're going to be talking with Clayton Campbell. Now, you may know him from the, Heartland Bowhunter TV show, right? They have a TV show, they have a web show, they have a huge following, and he's on their team. And today, man, I do a hunter profile on him. We talk about when he got introduced into hunting, how he got introduced to the outdoors. We talk about how he was introduced to bow hunting. We talk about, you know, his passion and when it kind of went into overdrive. We talk about the transition from maybe more of a mobile hunter to doing food plots, and how him joining the television show had made him have to focus on things other than, you know, planning food plots for good filming and all these other things. But most importantly, we talk about how he has introduced his kids into hunting. Now, his kids are older, so I ask him advice on what I should be doing to basically not pressure my kids into hunting. I want to make sure that every time I go out, it's a good experience. And we talk about that. And this is just a hunter profile podcast about two dudes who love the outdoors, and it's just a good old-fashioned conversation. Now, before I get into the podcast, we got to do a commercial. Now, I'm sure you've seen me on Instagram. If you follow me on Instagram, you need to. I wear a hat all the time, and it's from a company called The Average Conservationist. Now, not only do these guys make kick-ass apparel, they make some really cool shirts, hooded sweatshirts. They make a really cool, tons of cool hats. There's three right now that I'm wearing in rotation, and I'm debating on which one is going to be my tree stand hat for the upcoming year, or what one I'm going to wear on my hunts. And I have two I think that I'm kind of leaning towards. But regardless, these guys have a cool logo. It's an apparel company, and you need to go check it out, theaverageconservationist.com. Now, here's the cool thing. These guys donate 10% of all of their earnings to conservation efforts. That means when you're buying a hat from them, in a roundabout way, you are giving back to conservation. So donate to conservation, at the same time, get a kick-ass hat or a hoodie or a t-shirt. Again, theaverageconservationist.com. Check them out, buy some clothing, and give back, man. It's pretty simple. So there's the commercial. Enough of me talking. Let's get into today's episode with Clayton Campbell. And I'm going to start recording in 3, 2, 1. All right. On the phone with me today, Mr. Clayton Campbell. How you doing, man?
Doing fantastic. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, we're going to talk a whole bunch today about a variety of different things. This is going to be a bit of a hunter profile podcast. But the first thing that I always ask everybody is, where are you from and what do you do for a living?
Sure. I grew up in a little small Midwestern town just south of Wichita called Clearwater, Kansas. I won't fault you for not hearing about it. pretty small. I'd say like 4,000 people, and I'm sure everybody will correct me with that. But it was just a small town, had a co-op and a Casey's type of a scenario.
Yep.
Lived just south of town on the Nenasquaw River, and my family had a little bit of ground there for me and my cousins to run around on. That's kind of where my roots started, and at the present time, and hopefully we'll retire, I'm a land agent with Midwest Land Group, so I've kind of combined passions, so to speak, and doesn't feel like I've been working much lately with the opportunities I get to spend out in the outdoors.
Right, right. Let me ask you, as a land agent, how has the buying and selling of land been right now through this whole Corona thing?
You know, I think the housing market is a little bit different than the land scenario. I've actually seen an uptick in activity. That could be because some people are home more, you know, over the last couple of months. But, you know, as far as Midwest Land Group and the agents that I've been dealing with personally, my partners through the brokerage, man, we have been super busy. Not necessarily closing the stuff that we put under contract several months ago, but putting things under contract. I've been busier in the first, and about the last 2 months than I have been than what I can remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's been good. I mean, it's been good. It's been real. It's been great.
How are, you know, I'm from Iowa, and land prices, you know, I'm not a real estate guy. I'm not a land guy, but over time, you know, land prices kind of go up and then they maybe go down just a little bit and then they go up again. Where are Kansas land prices these days?
I think we're still, like you said, we're, you know, there's this trend, right, of kind of up, down, but the trend is up. I think I saw the last Missouri land survey, and I think we're like on a 7% increase. I don't think that's really any much different than Kansas, but you know, you ride the wave. I don't know if they'll continue to rise or not, but we're on a steady incline up. You know, it's just a great investment, and honestly, a usable investment that people are trying to really get a hold of. You know, they can put some money in land and get some equity and utilize it and hunt and fish and do everything else at the same time. So it's a unique opportunity to get diversified, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely a dream of mine is to someday own a chunk of land big enough. Like, here's my dream. I'm going to lay it out for you. Here's my dream. I want to be able to have a pond that has bluegill, crappie, bass in it. I want to have enough acreage to put a couple tree stands in there and chase deer, you know, especially for my kids, deer and turkey, and then maybe some CRP for, you know, some pheasants or something like that. Not a lot, but that's a dream. It's always been a dream of mine to own land and get what I want out of it, right? And then at the same time, maybe if it's if I have enough, maybe have a small operation where, not necessarily where I'm making a huge profit off livestock, but enough to raise for my own, you know, and maybe, you know, feed my family with it. So that's a dream of mine. And I think when you are dealing with a client, what are they looking for as far as, you know, when obviously you probably run into a variety of different people. Some are agriculture, some are recreational. Where's that split at?
You know, I just like to ask a bunch of questions, and for the record, I took a bunch of notes, and I'm going to put you in my database, Dan. You're now a potential buyer.
Well, I tell you what, man. Hey, if Kansas land prices are lower than Iowa's, which are they? Do you happen to know?
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah, especially on the tillable side.
Yeah. So, hey, maybe I'll be a landowner in Kansas.
Just full disclosure, you're going to be in my database.
That's all right. That's all right.
I love to ask a bunch of questions to really get to the root of how I can best help and serve my clients.
Yeah.
So just through a bunch of series of questions and trying to understand their end goal, you know, we can try to determine what type of farm, whether it's multi-use or just straight ag or potential home build site or you name it. Just like with what you mentioned, everybody wants either a pond or live water, you know, enough acreage to maybe hunt some deer. The pheasants, that's really how I got my passion into the outdoors, is chasing pheasants with my dad. I don't know if he had enough money to really buy a bird dog, so I was kind of that for him. You know,
I've been there.
Yeah. So, but the same thing, people, you know, they kind of want to be, I don't want to say self-sustainable, but, you know, they want to be able to have an opportunity to utilize the benefits of what the land has to offer. And so whether you have a couple cows or chicken coop or you name it, you know, that's my dream too, is to, you know, have a farm that is multi-purpose. And not only that, but man, just sharing those things with your kids as they grow up, those are experiences that they won't get inside anywhere else in the city. So you get them outside and let them problem solve and do those things. And I just think it produces a better kid when you get them outside.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I want to kind of transition now into something that you said about, you know, pheasants and how you kind of cut your teeth on pheasants. I want to ask you this question. What is your earliest childhood memory of the outdoors?
That's a very good question. I would have to say sitting on the bank of the famed Croker's Pond with my dad and Jigs and Lorraine. Like, there was this one spot around this, at the time it felt like a lake. Now it's much smaller because I'm a little bit bigger, but I would sit there and watch bobbers go under with crappie as they got pulled out of the water. That's probably my first childhood memory about the outdoors.
Right. So did you,
I was living the best years of my life doing that.
Yeah. It's almost like that. There's like a country Western song where the guy's like, "This could be the best day of my life." And he's talking about going fishing with his dad.
Right.
So, and by the way, I'm a horrible singer, so I apologize there, but,
nailed it.
Watch out, George Strait. Anyway. So did you come from an outdoor family? I mean, were your parents or your uncles all outdoorsmen and women?
You know, I remember seeing pictures. The answer is yes. Like, I remember seeing a picture of my grandma and grandpa in a 1950s car holding shotguns and pheasants. And so, you know, my grandma Millie was pretty BA. Like, she, you know, she got out there and did that stuff and owned her own little bakery. And so the outdoor roots run pretty deep within my family, aunts and uncles. And it really was birds for us, is what my dad did a lot of fishing and bird hunting. So dove, and not so much duck, not much on the waterfowl, but upland, you know, we did a lot of pheasant hunting and quail hunting. And that's what I, you know, becoming a pheasant dog and a retriever, the first several years of my life before they let me carry a 410 with no shells. That was kind of how I got started.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, man, that is one of my first hunting experiences outside of, you know, as far as the outdoors are concerned, outside of fishing. My uncle picks me up one day and he says, "All right, you want to come pheasant hunting with me?" And I was like, yeah, let's do this. And I don't know how old I was, probably 11, 10 years old, something like that. And he gave me a 12 gauge, and I just remember it being so heavy that I don't know how I was going to do it. And he had this lab Weimaraner mix, and his name was Cujo. And this dog was just really good, and he wouldn't point. He would just go get the pheasants and bring them back to you without jumping them up most of the time. So I can just remember he popped a pheasant up, and I shot him, and it kicked. And I thought I was the greatest hunter alive. I didn't want to go hunting anymore. All I wanted to do is go brag to my grandma and brag to my mom. And that right there is one of the first hunting memories that I have. I still have the picture in my office here somewhere, and I don't know, man. Pheasant hunting is something that I wish I could do more of, but in Iowa the pheasant populations are down a little bit. What are the pheasant populations like out in Kansas these days?
Yeah, first off, man, that's a cool story. Yeah. I love hearing that. Like I can see myself in that position, and I, you know, put my son in that position here a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. where there's just nothing better than having cousins and uncles and dads and, you know, everybody tromping through grass and eating salami and crackers at the end of the run, you know,
Just,
I love, that's awesome. But yeah, pheasants are down. It's not fantastic mm-hmm. where we've been hunting. My dad, he's the all-time guide when we go back. He usually scouts places, and he raises vishulas and short hairs. And Miss Sally is number one on the list right now for the gun dog. But it's been a little rough. I mean, we always do Thanksgiving and Christmas family hunts, but we always have a good time.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's just not as many long tails on the tailgate.
Yeah. I hear you. All right. So I'm personally a whitetail nut. You know, I'm that crazy guy who thinks about it every day. When did you start deer hunting?
A little bit later than what most people might do. For whatever reason, I remember my Uncle Bob. So we lived right on the river. You know, I could see trees from in a wheat field from essentially my bedroom window, and just never had never had an influence to, you know, to have that spark. And I remember my Uncle Bob shooting deer and seeing it as he, you know, pulled it out of the bottoms, and he's the one that got me started. I remember the old bare green razor head broadheads that, you know, I went down into his basement and I would just tinker with him. And honestly, it might have been just because he was giving me some attention on something that I wanted to understand more about. But yeah. I just remember just getting immersed in that. And that switch flip. I didn't have a lot of money, but I remember asking my parents to get me a white a bow for Christmas. I remember it was a Bear Whitetail too that they got somewhere. I have no idea. And man, I just started throwing curveballs with arrows. was what it felt like. And, at a hay bale near the red barn, and
yep.
walking around with, like, your dog. I had an Alaskan Malamute. She came with me, and, you know, we'd sneak through hedgerows and stuff where I grew up. There's a mix of pasture, timber, rough pastures. And I remember seeing my first deer fight, you know, climbing up in hedge trees, trying to get something done. It took several years to even get a shot at one. That was, so it was at the end of my high school career is kind of when I started to have that passion.
So in your mid-teens is when you kind of got interested in bow hunting, and then it took you a while. I mean, you started off bow hunting, right? It sounds like you didn't start off with a gun.
No. No gun hunting. It was just a bow. It was kind of funny. During the pheasant season, I remember my dad and my uncles, sometimes they would buy deer tags to some of the pheasant ground that we were hunting. You know, it was like they would always put a slug like in the number five hole, just in case,
yeah.
you know, they had a deer run by, but that was just, you know, for fun, I think. But yeah, it was just straight bow right out of the gate.
Right.
And, started from there, man. It was a long, hard road because I didn't have anybody to didn't have any tree stand money. I just was kind of like a little Indian kid, trying to go out and bring meat back for the family.
Right. That's funny you say that, because I can remember when my mom got me my first bow and we got a bale of hay from my grandpa's yard, and or from my grandpa's farm. And all my arrows were different. All the heads were different, so what I know today is like, you need to have consistently, your arrows need to be weighing consistent, so you're shooting accurate. And I hit 10 arrows or 5 arrows, not even close to one another on this bale of hay. And I was like, man, I am ready. I am ready to hunt. Just looking back at it. Yeah. Yep. I hit it. Oh, deer are going to die. Right. And, I look back at that now. I'm like, ooh, I probably should have stayed out of a timber, a little bit longer and practiced my archery. But, just like you, it's that learning curve that actually teaches us. It's not somebody else. It's our experiences that have a lot of weight in what direction we go. How long did it take you, to understand what deer were doing, understand, how they reacted to your pressure, understand, like body language and all these things?
Man, I would say quite a while. I didn't understand how keen deer were back then. And just like you, man, it's almost like I'm in my front yard right now with those 21-17 game getters, with the 5-inch fletchings.
Yep.
And those bare razor heads. I can like almost see it, in my hand. So it taking me back. Good, put the way back hat on for that. But it took me a while. And the one thing I always try to tell people that are getting started, everybody tries to jump ahead in, well, did you get a deer?
Right.
I think it was, if I can remember, probably 1, 2, like maybe 3 seasons before I harvested a deer, it felt like.
Yeah.
And I do remember that one, by the way. But I learned so much of how I was doing it wrong that I think it really propelled me, because I was kind of prideful. You got a bow for Christmas? Well, did you get a deer this year? Nope. Nope. Mm-hmm. So I had to say nope several times, but it really propelled me into try to understand, okay, in this game of chess that I don't know much about, how can I stack these odds in my favor? So it was a struggle, to try to see deer. Plus, we just didn't have that many around where I lived, like out my back door, because I didn't have a lot of time to drive somewhere and spend extra time with all my extracurricular activities. So essentially I had to go behind the house, which is literally a cow pasture with a small creek.
Yeah.
With hedge trees that were maybe 10 feet tall. So my ground game got good.
Yeah. And I'm sure that was frustrating, right? Cause you at some point you had to have learned that tree stands probably give you the advantage. Right. And if I had to guess, you were getting frustrated in that 3-year, in that 3-year time, because on the ground, there's probably some benefits to hunting from the ground, but wide open Kansas, you're basically having to use these hedge trees and the terrain to hide yourself. Were you getting frustrated at times to the point where you ever thought about setting it down?
No, it was just throwing more logs on the fire. Yeah. Really. Was pretty determined that I wasn't going to let that win. That frustration and that, I wouldn't even say, I would say frustrated. It was, but I didn't ever get upset about it. It was just more wood for the fire. And so understanding, obviously just when I would see a deer track, it was exciting. And so when I would see a rub, it was like, oh my gosh, like I must be doing something right.
Yeah.
And so I do remember finally figuring it out that, okay, where do you see all the deer in the evening? Okay. They're on the wheat fields. Okay. Then where are they going to go back? And so I started to, because no one was telling me, I didn't read magazines or anything. It was all self-taught type scenario, which, I just love because I can claim it as my own. And, climbing up in nooks of crooked hedge trees was the way to get off the ground, even 5 to 8 feet to see a little bit further. And, from there, once I got into college, it was my freshman or sophomore year in college when I finally got, you know, used some of that Pell Grant money that I probably should have been buying books with. And
I love
bought
it.
A tree stand at Walmart.
I love it.
bought a pallet worth, you know, maybe bartered a pallet of wood off somebody and built several tree houses and tree stands. And so
that's funny.
You know, that's when it felt like I started to get into the game.
So did your hunting passion or hunting time spent hunting overall slow down when you got into college?
I hope my mom's not listening. It probably doubled or tripled.
Hey, that's a good thing. You know, I tell you what, my mom would have probably appreciated if I would have done more hunting and fishing and less of what I actually did. And but you know, for me, it was hunting took a backseat at that point. I was into the social thing, you know, the bars, the girls, the, you know, tailgating, the, you know, I played rugby and whatnot. But, so when you got to college, it just was like overdrive from there.
Oh yeah. I can't even tell you. I can probably count on one hand the times that I went to a bar in the first several years of college, 'cause I was either working or out in the woods. A really dear friend of mine, Ron Mason, aka Rumpy, he and I spent so much time out in the element, just couldn't get enough. I'm sure there was a teacher or two that counted us both absent a time or two, whether it be chemistry or you name it, but we really hit overdrive, yeah, like you said, when in college. Yeah, we spent a ton of time outdoors.
So late teens, early 20s is when... Is that when you would say you became hardcore? I mean, is that when you would say, because I feel like there's different levels to someone's passion, right? For me, college, I was low. I did it when there was nothing else to do, or when I would go back home for a break. And then after college, even I jumped into the working world, felt like I was missing something. And then in 2006 is when I cannonballed back into the outdoors, right? Specifically deer hunting. Was that the jump off for who you are and what you are now?
Yeah. And here's another thing too that just came to mind. I remember doing an interview for a college class. I can't even remember which one, speech or composition or something. I interviewed the local taxidermist here, Bruce Jameson, here in Pittsburgh, because I wanted to know more. Like, I wanted to immerse myself in this outdoor, you know, industry, and ended up buying a bow from him, a Pearson spoiler, because I'd had another one, that Bear Whitetail 2, got stolen down here in college.
Dang.
And that also kind of, that was another step up in my game. I didn't have a ton of money. Again, I probably used book money for that bow too, but the key point was I didn't have a ton of money, but I had a ton of time to give to the sport. So I would say, if you know, time, treasure, talent, I gave all my time, probably more than the fair share, to the hunting thing, just because I enjoyed it. And it was really kind of a camaraderie thing. Like, Rumpy and I would, you know, trap and chase geese and snow geese and ducks and, well, I mean, whatever was in season, we were at it. I mean, we were at it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy, man. So you started diving into the outdoors. Now, I want to talk about deer hunting specifically for a moment, because I'm a nut and you're a nut. When did you start really focusing on strategy? And what I mean by that is, you know, wind direction, access routes, you know, maybe we should plant some food plots, or maybe we need to get, you know, mobile, or maybe, you know, you're looking at terrain and all that stuff. When did you become obsessed with it? Like the strategy game?
That's a very good question. I would say probably in the 15 year ago category. And a really good friend of mine, Kirk Colt, they kind of took me underneath their wing too. I met him the first day of microbiology lab class. He was the only kid wearing camo. So beeline to that table.
Did we just become best friends?
In a heartbeat. I mean, I fell in love right there with the camo. And so he and his family had been doing the strategy, and not so much maybe on the food plots, but studying, you know, over time, his dad and his uncle Bruce, his dad Larry and Uncle Bruce, they were nuts. And so I kind of immersed myself with Kirk too. So we would hunt together every year and I would learn from him, and they are kind of hard-nosed, old school, big timber, you know, saddles and all these things. So anybody that had a passion, I was listening and asking questions of, because I'm not going to sit here and tell you I learned it all myself, but I'd ask a lot of questions.
Yeah.
So I'd say about 15 years ago, really started to try to understand travel patterns, bedding area. I didn't have a lot of ground to hunt, so it was a lot of public. I did have some private land to hunt with my buddy Rumpy.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you lose, you try to figure out how to win.
Yeah.
And when that happens, you know, you figure out access routes. Now I'm probably overly cautious on things. I think my nickname is Cautious Clayton because I'm, you know, I don't, you know, Skyler calls me Cautious Clayton a lot of times. Well, it'll never fail. We'll be sitting in a tree 9 times out of 10 and he'll say, maybe we should be in that tree. Maybe
right.
We should be in that tree.
Right.
Maybe that tree. And for me, we always start on the outside and kind of work our way in. No cannonballs, no, you know, rash decisions.
Yeah.
You know, it's because it only takes one time to bump a deer, a big, big deer, and the game's over, maybe for the season.
Yeah.
And so I think kind of like with this COVID-19 thing you got going on, you got to be real careful about how you interact and, you know, wiping down things, and you want to be real safe and careful. That's kind of the way I approach the whitetail woods is, you know, I assume that any time that I mess up, I could be bumping the 170 or the deer, even the 140 that I'm hunting out, and he goes nocturnal or moves.
Yeah.
And so I try to keep that mentality, even checking trail cameras. And, you know, people say they get used to deer be a human behavior in their woods. And that's probably true, but I always err on the side of caution, or at least try to.
Yeah. Yeah. I find myself doing that a lot, especially at my age. I turned 40 this November. So quick question. How old are you?
Welcome to the club.
Oh, buddy. I'm not there yet, but I'll accept your entry.
Yeah, I'll say I'm halftime. I'm probably halftime of my life. So if I make it, you know, we'll just say if I make it to 90, I'm almost a halftime.
Okay, I gotcha. So I have a problem with that too, where I just overanalyze everything to the point of probably doing myself a disservice, as opposed to just going with my gut feeling, saying, all right, dude, you know that you need to be on this ridge, on this side of the ridge, half, you know, one third of the way down, the wind's doing this, thermal's doing this, blah, 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 blah. But what I'll do is, hey, there's also another ridge over here where I could be, or there's a, you know, this wind could be awesome over here, or this, or this, and this. And then I just overanalyze everything to the point of I start questioning myself, and I should just be making a decision and getting in the tree.
Yeah. I've probably been there too. The good and bad thing about that is when you, let's call it, man, another good friend, Justin Dill, we call it the whitetail calculator, right? You put in all of your variables, all of your numbers, and
absolutely
the equals, and if there's what feels like a successful outcome to that, you trust it. You know, you trust the spot, you trust all of your homework, all of your decision making, all of the prep, and that'll help you sit in the tree longer. And so I do love that part of it. The other thing is if a cell camera goes off on the other side of the farm, you're like, oh man, maybe am I missing something over there?
Yeah.
What, like, why that ridge? And sometimes it's just right place, right time, as we all know, or right doe, right time, whatever, you know, whatever the scenario
right,
is. But
right.
Just like you, my mind's always moving. You know, what can we do to improve? What can we do to tweak? What, you know, and Skyler does a really good job. Skyler works with my hunting partner with Harlan Bowhunter. We take notes, and he does there for a while. We'll do a journal, you know, time, temperature, those types of things. So we could take it to that next level and try to determine maybe certain days or weather patterns. And so you can never completely get it figured out. We can put as many chips on your side of the table as possible. So we try to do that just to maximize our time, because time is precious. Time is valuable, yeah. Especially in the sweet November phase.
That's right. That's right. So let me take a step back here, and I want to talk to you about the point in your hunting career where maybe you started switching from, maybe you didn't even go through this. Maybe I'll just ask you, walk us through your progression as a bow hunter. And what I mean by that is, it's brown, it's down. And then you went to, hey, I only want to shoot bucks, or I want to, fill the freezer, or I want to pass, young deer to hopefully get them to an higher age class, or were you more focused on antlers? Kind of walk us through that timeline.
Sure. I'll just say this. I love harvesting animals with my bow, whether they're, a 1 year old doe or the wariest of old does. I do try to harvest mature bucks in this phase of my life, but there for a while it was, it was just getting the experience of harvesting animals with my bow. So there were several smaller bucks, little basket racks that I shot. But as every progression really of anything that you do, you try to get better and maybe achieve a different goal. I would say within 2 or 3 years, maybe 4 years after shooting my first buck, I really wanted a nice one, quote, air quotes.
Yeah.
over 100 inches or so. And so I think as I fooled more deer or put myself in positions to see more deer close, the stakes went up in the game. So I thought, okay, if I've done this right, then maybe if I wait longer, a bigger deer will come by and I'll, hit a different echelon in, my success, so to speak. And I say that lightly and loosely, but it really wasn't always about the biggest of the antlers. It was really just trying to achieve a goal. I never really shot many big deer back then, but boy, I saw some, and that would drive the passion of, man, if I just wait a little bit longer. But even to this day, man, I love harvesting does. I love eating the meat. I love sharing that with other people. But I'd say probably in the last 10 years, especially maybe with the Heartland bow hunter side, trying to harvest a mature animal, maybe even a specific animal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Has been a passion. Food plotting, just putting in extra work, Sean and Mike all, drive that passion for us guys on the team, because we just try to improve habitat for the animals that we are chasing. And if it gives us a better opportunity to harvest more and let's call it, an older age class animal, then fantastic. We're willing to put in that time investment for the return.
Yeah.
And it's really, and honestly, there's a memory factor in that too, that is doesn't get talked about a ton, but I remember Skyler, one of my favorite hunts ever. I filmed him shooting a deer he calls Brick, which had actually shrunk from the year before. But his boys were in town. His wife was in town. We got them on the track. It was it was one of the best experiences that I've ever had in the woods. And it was 118 inch deer. I can't even explain to you how fun and memorable of a hunt that was. It wasn't his biggest deer. Matter of fact,
Yeah, let me ask you.
It was just an interesting scenario, but it was the best deer that he could have ever shot that year.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Do you remember a time or a specific deer where it was maybe your first time passing a big three-year-old or a four-year-old that was really hard for you? Do you have a memory like that? And I'll tell you what, I'll lead with a story. I had put together a hit list a couple years ago. No, this is maybe not a couple years ago. It's been like maybe 10 years ago. I had a hit list of bucks that I really wanted to have encounters with, and I really wanted to shoot. And I had one of those deers where I don't know if you've ever had a deer where you're like, please do not show up in front of me. Please don't, just don't stay away from me. I don't want to even be tempted with wanting to shoot you, because there's a possibility that the next year you turned into a magnum, right? So I had this deer, a three-year-old, you know, obvious three-year-old. He finally comes through during the rut chasing a doe, and he's maybe like a one, maybe a low 150s, high 140 class, and I passed him. And I was just second guessing myself, like shaking, just like, what did you do? You just passed a buck. You know, you haven't even shot a 150 before. What are you doing? Why did you do that? And I started like, I even had nightmares that night, like me passing that buck. And it was really hard, but I did see that buck grow into a bigger, you know, a 170 class the following year. I never had a personal encounter with him, but I got to see what happens when you pass a deer that's not quite mature yet. So did you ever have a scenario like that play out?
Man, this isn't going to be a very good story, but honestly, I cannot remember. I'm looking here at the deer that I have in my office, and each one of these I had history with.
Yeah.
And they're all, I passed all of the deer that I see here. I know that I had passed at least once or twice, but it was the goal. Usually Skyler and I get on the same page and say, okay, here's the yes and here's the no type yeah. thing for some accountability. But I honestly can't remember a deer that I've passed that I say I should have shot, knowing that the goal was already to let him get bigger. Now, seeing them, yes, I always love to see those big 3 and 4 year olds, you know, what they're doing, what travel corridors are they using, what are they doing, what time of day they're out. So I've seen, you know, I try to log some of that stuff, but honestly, it's probably a bad story telling that I've just not had a deer that has walked by that I said, man, I should have shot that. There's plenty that I've wanted to see.
Yeah.
Live. I mean, I've been pretty blessed with, you know, harvesting some pretty nice deer, and that right. has come because of patience.
Yeah. So how long ago, you said about 15 years ago is when you started getting into the strategy real hard. How long ago was it when you started really getting into the habitat side of things, like the, you know, whether it was hinge cutting or planting food plots or, you know, planting different warm season grasses or whatever? How long ago was that?
Very good question. So I'll ask this with a question. Does that include using my own rear tine tiller or a tractor?
It means if you cut down a tree, one single tree with a, let's say a handsaw, or, you know, did something to improve property or plant food plots. I mean, walk us through that progression, because right now you're doing a lot of work, right? What kicked that off? What started that?
Oh man. Yeah. So I'm looking at a deer called Tall Boy, which I think I probably should have let him get one more year older, but I got obsessed with this deer. He was on what's called the 6 acre wood. It's a little bitty spot that I had permission on. So super small, had to be super careful, only hunt it, you know, in certain, even like an evening with a certain wind. And so I thought, man, how can I try to beat this deer? How can I improve the odds? So I took a push mower and would mow down some grass, scalp it. I remember taking my own rear tine tiller out there to try to break up some ground to plant like what felt like a 10 yard by 20 yard strip of, you know, Hot Shot, whatever the cheapest thing was at Walmart. This is probably 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So that started it. So I just didn't have a lot of equipment to do it right. But I, you know, I planted a couple apple trees, you know, anything that I could try to do to improve, you know, back then my kids were small. So my, you know, diaper money and those types of things were more important than, it was just, I had enough time to try to improve my odds, and lo and behold, it, you know, it, would attract a couple more does and a couple more deer. And so that's kind of how that whole fuel got started. And then with Skyler and the filming stuff with HB, that, you know, we thought, man, if we're going to maximize our time and give us a progression of habitat management, you know, become better stewards of the land that we have access to, those types of things, that just gradually evolved into, you know, Old Blue, a Ford 3000 and a brush hog and a tiller and a three row planter and, you know, all kinds of things. But it is, I call it dirt therapy. I mean, it's just fantastic to get out and get a little bit mindless at times. Yeah. I said mindless, but you're thinking about, you know, just giving back to the land that's given me so much.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. So when you started going through that phase where you started manipulating the habitat, planting food plots, did you transition from a, or maybe you never were, from a go and get them to a bring them to us, wait, let's wait for them style of hunter?
A little bit. And I keep saying this stuff with Heartland Bowhunter, but we can't just sit in any tree with filming.
Yeah.
Because with two people in the tree, it's harder to be mobile and hard, you know, you kind of got to have a little bit of a post, so to speak, you know, to sit. And not every tree will hold a camera arm and two tree stands in the positions that we try to capture our video with. So I probably, over the years, I have a lot better spots to hunt to kill bigger deer, but some of those sets, you couldn't see a deer coming, or it just didn't create the story that we wanted to make. And yeah. So doing food plots, making a destination, entry, exit strategies, those types of things, you know, we just tried to go ninja level with, you know, our activity so we could maximize our time, really. I mean, I hate to say it, but
yeah,
when you only have a couple of days to make it work, you try to make it the best you can for that time.
Right. So would you say that when you made the commitment to filming, that almost forced your hand into changing the style of hunting that you wanted?
Some. Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. Especially with destination food plots, or giving yourself an opportunity to see more deer. For the longest time, I just didn't realize how much of a whitetail's behavior was driven by food. I just, whether I just didn't understand it or want to believe it, you know, I did not understand how much a deer really focuses on food. I mean, it is one of the key things that, and that's just how they survive.
And yeah.
I didn't, shame on me for not understanding that earlier, but now I understand it. And so we try to give them as much as we can, whether it be corn, beans, rye, wheat, clover, turnips, you name it. We just try to give them every opportunity to get in front of us that we can.
Yeah. Yeah.
We try to make it easy for them. I tell you.
When you made that transition, you know, to, I guess, having the camera guy come with you and making that commitment to filming, did you ever second guess yourself and say, man, I would rather kill a deer than I would, you know, get video of him?
Only a couple times after hunting for 4 months and not getting a target buck in front of us. But, you know, I will never trade any memories.
Right.
Hunting with the HB guys and my kids, like, that, there's so much reward there. So it's never been I just wish it were different.
Yeah.
You know, that's when you harvest a doe. That's when you take a kid, you know, and you feel like you're in the grind. But I've never said, man, I just wish it were different.
Yeah.
There's been times where I've taken my recurve and you know, a knife that my buddy forged, you know, out to the woods with three arrows, you know, and leave all the gadgets and gear behind and get back to my roots. So I've had a couple resets like that, you know, just kind of a get back to the basics type thing. But all in all, I'll never trade the hours in a tree stand with a friend.
Yeah. Are you still filming with those guys?
As much as I can, absolutely.
Okay. Yep. So, I don't know. I don't honestly consume a lot of hunting content outside of the occasional YouTube video, but let me ask you this then. Now you've done it, right? You've dedicated some time to the camera. You've dedicated some time to the food plots, to yourself. Now walk us through how you have gone about introducing your kids and the next generation into hunting, and talk about maybe some ups and downs there. Cause I got a boy, my oldest boy, right now he doesn't seem too interested in it, but I have my oldest daughter who is way more interested. Like yesterday we were out fishing and I said, okay, it's time to go. And she started crying because she wanted to fish longer. And then my other son, my youngest boy, he's 2, so he doesn't know too much right now, but my other boy is 5 and he's not quite into it yet like my daughter was into it at that time. So I want you to walk us through how you've gone about, you know, introducing your kids into hunting, and talk about, you know, maybe some ups and downs, and, you know, hey, have you ever felt like you've pressured them, or maybe some of the response that they've given to being outside?
Yeah, it's kind of the same. Sorry about that. Excuse me. It's kind of the same scenario with my daughter and son. Miss Addie, when she was probably 3 years old, big blonde curls, you know, just a ball of energy. I'd take her turkey hunting with her and her grandpa and me, and you know, I'd take several Barbies and backpacks with candy and books and those types of things.
Right.
But that's okay. That was the hook, and that's okay. And when she was tired of being there, we didn't hear any turkeys gobble. When she got bored, I'd say, hey, you want to go look for frogs or turtles or mushrooms or you name it. So on the walk out, at least we would get some other interactive time in the outdoors. And over time, she really enjoyed, whether it just was being outside or the attention from her dad or you name it, but she really, really enjoyed being outside and exploring.
Right.
And my son, not as much. He's just not as a morning person. So mornings for him are meant for sleeping, not getting up.
Right.
You know, Addie would, you know, go to sleep in her hunting clothes type of scenario. So, you know, she'd be bouncing off the walls as soon as she got out of bed. So that was a little easier. But I truly enjoyed time outdoors with them. And so they saw how much of passion that I had for the outdoors, and they would come along, and it made it fun and exciting too. And a little bit of work with Skyler when we started filming, you know, 10 years ago together, that it was had to do extra time, you know, to get ready and film some of those things. But it was, again, it was like a little mini hunt camp in the blind. Right. So whether we were spitting sunflower seeds or giggling or laughing, you know, I never got into the, hey, you need to be super quiet. You know, we would say those things, but it was just to try to give them an opportunity to see animals close. It wasn't like, oh, you're going to ruin this. You know, we've always tried to invoke an excitement and a drive for them to want to do it, whether it be checking trail cameras or, you know, putting down mineral or whatever. Yeah. I mean, hopefully over the years, the viewers of Harlan Bowhunter have seen the lighter side of some of the fun stuff that you get to do with your kids, you know, outdoors, you know, throwing dirt clods at each other, you name it.
Yeah.
And so over the years, I've just been blessed to have both kids harvest deer with, you know, they started with a shotgun, harvested the first couple deer when they were, you know, before 10 years old, both of them. And then Addie shot her first deer actually with a bow on one of the episodes. I think she might've been 10 or 11, maybe 11, you know, pulling 32 pounds and shot a little doe. And then the next year shot a almost Pope and Young buck with her bow, you know, at 12. And so both kids have harvested deer with their bows and been on several episodes. And those are my absolute favorite episodes.
How old are they now?
Miss Addie is a senior. So she, you know, depending on how the graduation thing is. Yeah. So she's going to be graduating and be turning 18 here in a couple, you know, like in 2 weeks, the last day of May. And Tate is a freshman in high school. So
okay.
Miss Addie's getting ready to head out to college. Yeah, they grow up fast.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. Yeah, absolutely. So what advice do you have for me? Give me some advice on how to get my kids pumped about the outdoors.
Yeah, man, I'm just going to say it how it is. If it takes candy, if it takes a book, a Barbie, a soda pop, a picnic, you name it, whatever the hook is for them, they say kind of a kid, you know, has an attention span about of their age. And so if you can get a fish to bite within 3 minutes, then, you know, it's going to keep them there.
Right.
And when they say I'm tired about it, like, hey, I want to go, you go. I mean, I don't know how many times I do have this one story. I remember taking Addie turkey hunting one time. I had a double blind in a backpack strapped case, and I had Addie sitting on my shoulders, leaning against, you know, essentially she was in a recliner on my shoulders with the blind back there, carrying all kinds of gear for a half a mile in, you know, just killing myself to get to the spot. No joke, within 20 minutes, no gobbles, and she's like, hey, I'm kind of bored and let's go. I'm like, you know, I said, are you sure? And she said, yeah, you know, this isn't fun for me. And I was like, okay, let's go look for some frogs and turtles on the way out. And I was packing up. And then before long, we had a bag full of morel mushrooms. You know, she's super good at finding those. And so at least we had an experience that was good. And I've never said, hey, kids, stick it out. Like,
yeah, tough it up.
Made this investment. Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's been times where I remember late season, those two turds, and I say that lovingly, they surprised me beyond belief. I mean, I was cold, and they stuck it out, and Tate ended up shooting a really nice doe out of a hay bale blind on a Wurzig farm, and I couldn't have been more proud of them, because I know it was cold. I mean,
yeah,
the hot hands and hot toes probably had worn out, and it was just brutally cold, and man, they stuck it out, and yeah. I was like, man, that is awesome.
Yeah.
Because they want, cool. I mean, they wanted the reward. They just buckled in, and man, if they had said let's go, I'd have said yeah. I'm hurting, my toes are cold. Let's get out of here. And they never did.
Yeah, that's crazy. I tell you, I learned in a very short period of time. This was the first year I ever took my daughter out turkey hunting, and she was up at 3:30 in the morning. And I went out, I had to go get a drink or go to the bathroom or something. And I walked out to the kitchen, and she was already up, sitting up on the couch. Like, is it time to go yet, Dad? And I'm like, no, like in 1 hour when the alarm goes off, then we'll start getting ready. But she walked to the blind in the dark without a flashlight. She, you know, was not afraid of it. She was pumped, ready to go. But one thing that I had to learn was, you know, I had this expectation in my head where a tom was going to come in and I was going to shoot it, and it's the perfect scenario. Well, what I learned was that I think my expectations were too high. I need to learn how to, you know, get some lower expectation, because she was making noise. She was moving around a lot. You know, she was talking, but she was excited. So I think what I've come to accept is the fact that I need to maybe not expect, you know, a big time hunting adventure, and just take the little wins.
Yeah, you couldn't have said it better there. I'd say, and I was going to mention that before you, you know, let me know about that story, which is awesome. I love hearing when kids are excited like that to get outdoors. Is you really just can't have, the only expectation you should have is to have fun. That's it.
Yeah.
And give them the fun factor, because if that tangent gets into a direction where they think it's not fun, you lose.
Yeah.
And so any fun factor is a win, whether it be giggling or laughing, or, you know, ours was putting face paint on each other. So Addie would paint my face and I would paint hers, and lo and behold, I'd have, you know, X's and O's all over my face, and you know,
yeah.
But it was fun. It was a memory. And anytime I had a chance to give them an opportunity to go, to say, hey, I'm open this weekend, do you want to go? I wanted their answer to be yes. And so I tried everything I could to make sure that it was a yes from them when I had time to take them.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. Now, your kids in the next 5 years are all going to be out of the house, right? And you, it's just going to be you and the wife. What do you plan to accomplish? You know, obviously, you're still going to want to hunt and fish and do the outdoor thing with your kids. But as we come to realize, kids grow up and they go and they do their own thing. What are your personal plans and goals for the next, you know, 5-10 years?
Well, I'm hoping that now that Addie's in college, she'll have a little extra time to hunt. Yeah. And so I'm looking forward to that. You know, schedule might be a little more flexible. So I hope to get more time with her out in the outdoors. Same thing with Tate. I know he's super busy with theater and, you know, all his extracurricular activities. So it's still hopefully going to keep them engaged in the outdoors. And for me, I'm sure I'll apply for some out-of-state tags. The thing about it is Skylar and I typically hunt together all the time, and his kids are kind of getting a little bit, you know, they're probably 5 and 3 now. So he might not have as much time to get away, but hopefully I can do some hunts that I just had to kind of put on pause for a while. So Montana elk, we've talked about going back up to Canada to go moose hunting. We did that hunt probably 6-7 years ago, something like that. So there's a few, I'm not going to say bucket item list, but hopefully with the flexibility that I have with Midwest Land Group, and as long as I'm successful doing, you know, what I'm doing, it gives me a little flexibility to maybe take a 7-day trip somewhere else besides Kansas or Missouri.
Yeah. Do you have a bucket list hunt that you've, because it sounds like you've done elk before, it sounds like you've done moose before. Is there another animal or another state that you really want to get to in the next handful of years and experience another hunt?
Man, other than just maybe caribou, like I've always, and it's probably just to see the migration. Like, yeah. I've always been a biology guy and love National Geographic type stuff. And so
absolutely.
It's not been a, you know, I'm not going to spend extra time and effort to get there and pay out the nose to do it. It would be fun to see, even if I just went and took pictures of that stuff, it would be awesome. But I don't necessarily have a bucket list hunt. I know it's kind of a boring answer, but it would be absolutely fun to go back up and harvest a moose myself. Skylar got one when we went back up there. That meat was amazing. The scenery was amazing. Friends were amazing. The experience was amazing. Getting across the border was not amazing, but you know now what not to do. And so
right.
I'd say another moose hunt. It's probably going to be in the cards.
Yeah, that's definitely on my list as well. Well, Clayton, man, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks for coming on, and thanks for BSing with me for a while. And good luck the rest of the spring with whatever you're doing, and good luck this upcoming fall as well.
Yeah, man, appreciate the time. It was such a pleasure to get to talk about old memories to you. Thanks for bringing some of those back. And yeah, let's keep in touch.
And that brings us to the end of another Hunter Profile podcast here on the Nine Finger Chronicles. I have a feeling we're going to have Clayton on again because he has a really cool knowledge base for land and strategy and planting food plots and all that stuff. So we may have him on before the season again just to BS with him. Other than that, man, if you're not subscribed to the Sportsman's Nation podcast or the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, please go to iTunes, leave a 5-star review, get subscribed, and get all these on a regular basis, man. I hate to be cocky, but I really do think I'm putting out some really good content. And if you listen carefully, you can take away something from every single podcast, whether it's strategy, whether it's how to balance work and life or hunting and life, whether it is, you know, one thing or the other. I really think that that you can take a lot out of these podcasts. So be sure to subscribe. Other than that, make sure you're visiting the Sportsman's Nation website, sportsmansnation.com. And man, huge shout out to the partners of the Nine Finger Chronicles, right? If it wasn't for them, this isn't happening, right? So we have Ozonix, Wasp, Lone Wolf, The Average Conservationist, and Vortex Optics. Please go out and support the companies that support this podcast because it comes full circle, right? So, and I'll tell you another thing. Keep an ear out for upcoming episodes where I am going to be, probably doing some giveaways. And we're going to be trying to get some products in your guys' hands. Other than that, man, be safe. Try to get outside, breathe some fresh air, get away from the stress of the world, and we'll talk to you next week.